Hello and welcome. Simon Jacobson here, speaking to you from the Holy Land, literally right near the Mediterranean Sea. We will be posting on the site something I recorded just before this class as the sun was setting over the water, because I thought it was appropriate to the topic that we will be discussing. And this is part three of the Vice Advice series. In this part, we're going to be covering the topic of desire. Part one covered anger. Part two covered pride, arrogance. They were both under the archetype of fire, Eish. And part three is the archetype of water, which gives birth and gives growth to all matters of pleasurable desires, as I was citing from Rab Chaim Vital in the Shari Kedusha, as cited by the Alter Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya, Rabbi Shneur Zalman, in Tanya, the end of the first chapter. In the subcategories of desire and pleasure include coveting, which we'll be covering next week, part four, and envy and jealousy in part five, and then the following parts, which go on with other archetypes of air, wind, and then finally earth, as we shall discuss them. As I've said in the previous weeks, these are all self-contained parts. However, it would always be helpful to see the comprehensive picture if you listen to the previous ones, which are all on our site and can be easily accessed in our archives. So let us go to desire and discuss this vice. But as I've been discussing, every vice is a zele umaze, is a alter ego of a positive side, because there's no such thing as negative energy that doesn't have a positive power to it. It's a matter of having almost alter egos, parallel universes. But we're discussing, as we've been discussing, the focusing on the negative, so to speak, even though the objective is to shine the light, because the best defense is offense. And yet we want to probe and understand the exact anatomy of desire, as we did with anger and vanity. And that's what we shall be doing. And obviously each one of us knows what desire is. Desire either for the good or for the bad. It's a very much part of our lives. But here's the interesting thing. Rab Chaim Vital, in the Shari Kedusha, and cited in Tanya, both say that the language is almost word for word in Tanya from the Shari Kedusha. Why is pleasure and desire connected to water? So he says there, because water, all desires, matzmichim min ha-mayim, grow from water. Now that makes sense when you're talking about edibles. That obviously, the of all foods that grow, that we have pleasure from, and joy and desire, are a product of water, because without water, things can't grow. But what does it have to do, for example, with other desires, like sexuality? The pleasure and desire and lust for sexuality. Or other pleasures that people have and desires. Again, whether it's good or negative desires, but what is it connected to water? So clearly, the water here is not just a physical thing that it makes things grow. As we know, everything in the physical evolves from the spiritual. So you have to say, why do water make things grow? Because water has properties. It's an archetype, more than just the physical water. Its spiritual counterpart, where water is rooted, its spiritual energy, so to speak, is associated with all types of pleasure, including those that are not necessarily connected to things that grow. So water is the thing that nourishes and nurtures and cultivates all forms of desire. So let's analyze that a bit more. What is desire? We know that people who are not alive, dead people, don't desire things. I've always been using, and I think that one of the best ways to get to the pure root of something is to look at it in its purest form, by dissecting in its purest form before it's assumed man-made and distortions that we impose upon our desires. So the best place to look is at children, how they desire things. So desire is very synonymous with wanting things. You desire. Whether you desire food, whether you desire pleasures from playing games for children, or other desires that they have on their level, it's part of what's called being alive. Part of the soul's restlessness, you can say, and spirit looking for to fulfill more than just necessities. Because you don't call a necessity a desire. When you eat bread, for example, and water, just the basic need for what the minimum we need to survive, we don't call that tainug. We don't call that pleasure. Pleasure is always something additional, something unique. Like, let's say a person has pleasure going to a party. A person has pleasure going on vacation. A person has pleasure reading a book. Tainug, to me, the ena tainug is an expression. Ongoing desires or ongoing pleasures is not pleasurable. Pleasurable is based on something unique, something new, something novel. So that tells us that we are all in need of not just the basic minimum. Let's take animals, for example. They hunt for prey, or they go feed, whether they feed in vegetation or a mineral, not because of a profound desire. The desire is a result of their survival. They need it, so therefore they desire that food. But you don't find any indulgence. When animals hunt for prey, they hunt exactly what they need for their love. They don't save anything just for pleasure, for dessert, so to speak. It's the human being that has that additional component that desires things, which can get us into trouble, but can also lead us to great places. So when you talk about nature, as I've discussed many times, in nature, everything is balanced like a clock. A clock is not more and not less. So you don't have that concept of additional or extra pleasure. Take, for example, even sexuality by animals. For some, there are romantic and complex, sometimes courtships that different animals, different species play in order to attract, in order to show that they are superior, or whatever it may be. But you don't see the element of indulgence. As a matter of fact, in many animals, they do the act that's necessary in order to lay eggs or in order to impregnate the female, or whatever it is that takes to be able to perpetuate the species. There's no extra pleasure. Human beings can extend something for a long period of time and indulge themselves and wallow in their own desires. We will soon be talking about different types of desires, the healthy form and the non-healthy form. So when you think of desire in that sense, it needs to be fed. It needs to be watered. And that's why water, it's more than just, that's why water actually gives growth, bears fruit and makes things grow. Because water adds that dimension that on that existence on its own would not have. And that is, it makes things grow. So if you think about, we sometimes say, my desire is growing. My desire is being ignited. My passions. All these words, if you think about them, they need to be fed. And they're fed by the archetype called water. Now when you think of water, water itself is also a very refreshing thing. Water is refreshing if you throw cold water on your face. It's a cleanser. We bathe and luxuriate in water, whether it's at the beach, whether it's in a bath, whether it's in a spa. So water is associated with pleasurable activity. In addition to the fact that when we are in water, we feel a certain belonging. Some attribute that to the sense that the 9 months we were, where were we? We were submerged in the embryonic fluids. The Talmud says, the Medrash and Talmud say, and the Kabbalah explains, that all of us are a microcosm of the universe, and the universe too was submerged in water before God divided the higher waters and the lower waters on day two of creation, which explains why we gravitate toward water. So the evolutionists will theorize and say we gravitate, some say, because we evolved from amphibians and we have any water, we somewhat have still have watery aspirations, so to speak. And the Kabbalists will say the exact opposite. The soul originates from the waters, the secret waters, what they call the hidden worlds. The Alma Discasia, like the water that covers everything beneath it. So the higher waters are the spiritual waters that we are submerged in. And Moses, of course, is the epitome of what a human being can reach. His name, Moshe, means Minamayim Mishisui. He was drawn from water. Why would he have such a strange name, which was given to him by the daughter of Pharaoh, even though his parents gave him a Jewish name, and different Talmudic opinions what that was. Most of us are not even aware of that. And this becomes his name, that forever and ever, for posterity, this is the name, Moshe. Because Moshe was a personified, the waterly world. the world of thought, where everything is submerged in a higher energy. On land, the creatures on land are not quite as, you can't call them submerged. Yes, we're dependent on oxygen, we're dependent on many things, but the submergence of fish in this water, when I say like I feel like a fish in water, is a type of glove inside, the hand inside the glove, where everything is seamless. And on a spiritual level, that means a seamlessness where the soul is completely connected to its source, like fish are connected to their source. So water represents, in that sense, a unity of a deeper place. And because the soul originates from the higher waters, like we say in the chapter, Vayetzi Yaakov Me'Be'er Sheva, that Jacob left Be'er Sheva. What is the Be'er Sheva? The fountain of seven. Fountain. Because this, and because we come from fountains, from water, and it says every evening when we go to sleep, the soul returns to its original fountain, spring, to refresh itself, obviously spiritually speaking. So water is this, not just refresher, it's a life giver. We know in science that life cannot exist without water. This is why whenever they see water, if they think there may be potential water on any distant planet, it's potential life. Because without water, there's no life. So water is not just, as I said earlier, just for survival and just for existence. It has that element of making things grow, making things expand, making things develop and cultivate. So desire is an outgrowth of that. And now, in a positive way, I've been talking about it so far all in a positive way, such waters should yield unbelievably powerful desires. But like anything that's powerful, the Talmud says, everything that Torah prohibits us, it also gave us something that is permitted, because these are, as I said, the alter ego of the parallel worlds. We're obviously going to be talking desire in the negative sense as well, but it's rooted in the idea of growth. And that's why we have our passions and we have our desires and we have our lusts. As I said, we'll be talking about coveting and envy in the next weeks. We're focusing on desire. Now, desire at its best is a human being aspiring and desiring and being passionate and driven to the highest transcendental experiences. Desire at its worst, to think of water. Water gives life, but water could also flood us and overwhelm us. When it overwhelms us with desire, we could desire things and not have any, be out of control. I lusted for it. I was out of control. It was so consumed me, that desire, could not control my actions. Now, of course, sexual desire is always that comes up first, especially in Freudian psychology. That is like the id, the desire, the passion, the unfettered or undiluted and unadulterated pure desire for the flesh. That is often what comes to mind. But we're not just talking about that type of desire. We're talking about desire in all forms where I want. It's the I, the id. I want. Have in the language of Tanya. Like the dog that says, give me, always taking. In other words, it's a completely selfish type of experience. Small malfunction here. Just bear with me. Sorry about that. Right. Yeah, take a breather before we get jump into the further discussions on desire. Just bear with me. Sorry about that. I guess I was getting so passionate in the world of desire that I just shook up the whole microphone. So that's a demonstration of what can happen. Small, slight, nothing serious. So now, okay. So with that sense, where it completely overwhelms you, that's what water is. It could flood you, but you can also live, we can't live without it. So what is what? How do you have to, what the key is? Balance, regulation. Making sure that there's enough water. Think of, let's say, rain. If rain came down in buckets, it would flood fields. It would destroy fields just as much as a drought would destroy it. By too much. Like the Talmud says, the story with Chayne HaMagel. Cheni HaMagel was called Cheni the Circler. Why? Because there was a famine in Israel, and he prayed for the rain. So the rain came coming down in buckets, flooding the fields. So he had to have a second prayer to say, Rev Teve en Yechel Mekabel. So much good, we can't contain it. And the second prayer, he actually began by making a circle, and he wouldn't leave the circle until the rain would come. And the second prayer was that the rain should not come in flood the fields, but should come down rain drops. Which is, of course, a tremendous lesson in everything, in education and communication. It's not just what you say, it's how much you say and how you regulate the pace, the flow. To speak too quickly, to communicate ideas that overwhelm a student or a child or a recipient, is just as bad as giving them too little information. So the key to water is to make sure it's paced and regulated, the flow is regulated, which is why we have faucets and we have filters. And we have regulators, and we have channels, which is, of course, the key to keep, say, containing desire, or I would say harnessing and channeling it in the right direction. But the anatomy, the heart of desire, is the human soul's need and want and desire and passion for something beyond, which is why you'll see the true pleasures that people gravitate to, even the simple ones, even people who love wine, or they love great flowers, the fragrance, they love to travel, or they have the passions in different areas, including, of course, love and sexuality and so on. What is really their aspiration? As you see, animals don't have that, is the aspiration for something that fills a need, fills a void in the soul seeking transcendence. And that's why these desires are so powerful. Because they are not just, if it's survival, fine, you finish eating, you have enough to eat, your body is fed, your body is nourished. But desire goes into a realm that is more mysterious, the mysterious secret world of water. And as I said, it can go in both directions. So now that we've established that, let's discuss this a bit further in discussing what happens when a person is consumed by desire. So there's an expression, chaylas ahava. In the Bible, chalasav means my love sick. When a person gets consumed with a desire, if you've ever experienced it, and I'm sure everybody's experienced it, it literally takes control of your life. It's an obsession to the point that your mind isn't even working necessarily, and at that point you can end up doing things that are very destructive, even while you know that they may be destructive. You don't think about it. There's such a rush of the desire, literally like a rush of water, that overwhelms you, like it floods you. And once it floods all your circuits, your mind and your heart, it's very hard to control yourself. Which is why desire can get us into such trouble. Take sexuality. Sexuality, the sexual act, especially for a man, the pleasure does not last long. However, the buildup, and all around it, and the imagination, and the scenario, and the courtship, and the chase, and the conquest, creates such, we know today, different chemicals, but it creates such a rush that is in itself the great desire, and even when it's fulfilled, it's almost anticlimactic in a way. Women too have great desires and pleasures. It works differently, perhaps, in the biological sense, but the same idea is there. It may be more watery, and for man it's more watery, meaning like a state of being, and for man love is more of a verb, an act, and for a woman it's a state of being. But nevertheless, each in their own way have these desires, and they are rooted, as we shall talk about, in very deep and holy places. But the bottom line is, once they become consume you, once they control you, and once they're directed in ways that are not necessarily productive, and that could actually end up hurting other people. You desire someone you shouldn't be desiring. You desire something you shouldn't be desiring. Then it spills over into the area of a negative vice, which is what, of course, the Tanya and Rav Chaim Vital, I should say, and the Tanya are addressing. And we need to get control over that. And we'll talk about how we get control. But first we are addressing, obviously, the most important question, which is, before we get into control, which is, what is it? What is it? So let me share a story. The Alter Rebbe, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of the Adi, who I'm citing from the Tanya, when he was arrested, so there was a false accusations of him helping the enemy of the Russian government, the Russian Tsar, which was Turkey, was the arch enemy, and Israel then was under the control of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. So the accusation was that the Alter Rebbe was sending money to Israel, which he was doing to support the Jews because they had no income, and to support the Jews. And as a result, he was accused of that. And of course, that led into, does he have any interest in mutiny, in overturning, in rebelling and revolting against the Tsar? All these accusations. Well, he was sent a psychiatrist, what we would call today, someone to test and give him an evaluation of this man. And he, through talking to him and through evaluating him, he saw that he has a tremendous fire and desire and passion for something. Maybe I shouldn't use the word fire here because we're using the word more water. But he had this tremendous passion and desire for something. And he sensed there was a desire for leadership, for being like a melech, a king, which of course would confirm some of the suspicions, false suspicions, that here's a man that was looking for power, which of course was a threat to the king, the Tsar of Russia. So when he was asked by the doctor, or whoever this was, this I don't know what they called the psychiatrist in those days, by this evaluator, by this minister, he was asked, what is it that I see you desire something? Malchus, which means shrara, which means control. So he says, yes, I desire Malchus of Etzilus, or Malchus of Ein Sof. The desire was for the divine, connecting to the divine sovereignty, to the divine king of the universe. So you could see from that how desire can go in two directions. It can be a desire for power. It can be a lust for control. It can be a lust for a human being, a man or a woman. It could be a lust for different pleasures of this world that we want to indulge in. Or it could be a lust for and the desire for the divine. So there you have the tremendous energy called desire and its connection to water. The interesting thing, since we're talking about water, that antithesis is to fire. Fire is a burning, even though you can say burning desire and burning passions, but here we're talking not the burning part of it, even though the focus of fire, even though there is an element of burning passion and burning desire, but fire was associated far more with anger and with vanity, as we discussed. So I'm focusing more pleasure as a desire connected to pleasure, that sense submerging and indulging in something, you know, like taking a long bath. Languishing is the word I was looking for. So it's more a waterly type of experience instead of it being this type of like tense and fiery and passionate desire. We're talking more the calm, the waterly dimension of desire, which does not exclude the fiery part, but the focus here is in this archetype of water, that element of it, which is really what we're looking for. There may be an element of fire in it, which is the drive, the igniting electricity within desire. However, the main thing that we really want in desire is enjoyment, is pleasure. You're not looking to burn. You're not looking to expire and to be consumed like a wick is consumed by fire. Instead, you're looking for that type of calm serenity, that I said, languishing, wallowing element that I could just indulge and lie in those waters of my own pleasures. And as a result, this, as I said, has two sides to it. The positive side, we'll be discussing a little more later. I want to now go to the negative side. The negative side is when a person ends up there and everybody has elements of it. Just think of, and I don't need to, you know, just use your imagination. You probably don't even need to use your imagination. How many times a day does a person think about sexuality? They say men think about it, I don't know, what is it, 100, 200 times, not an hour, a day or more. Women maybe less. Well, just think of all the things that you dream of, that you desire. Even if you're not fulfilling it, it takes up your mind and in many ways pollutes your mind. Because sometimes, as I said, wanting can be even more pleasurable than having. So the want, it can be part of what consumes us. And when that consumes you, you really don't have room and space for other things that may be fulfilling the mission of your life. So in essence, it's really the ultimate epitome of selfishness. Going back to Freud, sexual desire, the raw sexual desire of the id. Me, me, me. I need my pleasure. I need whatever I need. Is consumption with yourself and not with others. Now the desire may require another person. It may require another thing or another experience. But that's not what you're looking for. You're not looking for them. You're looking for them to satisfy your needs. So it's the epitome of narcissism in a sense. And of selfishness. In its worst form. So it's the worst form. That's what, and that's why the Chavos HaLevavos, which is a great classic work, The Duty of the Hearts, by Bechaye, Rabbeinu Bechaye, says that you cannot have the love of the universe and the love of God at the same time. They don't work together. Because when a person is loving and desiring, let's say, their next meal, or their next sexual interaction, or their next indulgence in a card game, or gambling, or sports, even things that may be more innocuous and not destructive, the bottom line is that's where your love is. And you can't be loving two things at once, especially two antithetical things. Loving God, when we say v'ahavtas Hashem l'kecha, love, passionate, chaylos ava, we say ava with ava kirish b'esh, ava kamayim, with a passionate love and desire, is for the divine. It's for something beyond you. It's for something that goes, that transcends your own needs. It's still a tremendous desire when you learn how to appreciate it, which we will discuss, but it's initially going in a very different direction. One is about me and my needs and desires, and the other is about what I'm needed for, and something that is God-centric instead of ego-centric. So that's the essence of why desire becomes a force that really does not allow you to really be there for other people and be there for God, to serve. Because you're serving yourself, and the desire can completely overwhelm, as we've discussed. So in that sense, desire is, as I said, once it's out of control, it becomes something that blocks us from really growing in any particular way. And you see this when people are in the throes of desire, in the throes of their pleasure. What's the story? You can't get their attention. You can't get them to think about anything. When do most people wake up, or most people are responsive, is when they're not happy, when there's sadness, when there's melancholy, when there's a loss, when there's a death. In the throes of desire, very few people you can get their attention. And it could be completely trivial and frivolous of desires. But that's what's happening now. I am excited about what I'm going to do. And it could be completely petty and childish, but that's what takes over your life. Which is why it's something we need to address. Now, you could argue, and this I'm going now with the same model that I've done the previous weeks, that the only way to do this is refraining. The only way to do this is eliminating. Depriving. Deprivation. Depriving ourselves of those desires. But we all know, is that easy? Not easy at all. Even when those desires can be destructive, sometimes the almost the danger involved, the mayim gnuvim yim taku, the waters, stolen waters are sweeter, the illicitness of it can be very big draw, can be a very big draw. So the challenge here is, how do we get to a place where we do not deprive, but we learn to channel? Now, here's a very important point. In Hasidic thought, there are two steps in all disciplines. One is called iskafia, and one is called ishapcha. These are words from the Zohar. They're Aramaic that mean, iskafia means to deprive, or more important, to refrain. From the word iskafia, from the word kfiya, forcing yourself, imposing, coercing yourself not to do something, stopping yourself. And then there's a thing called ishapcha. Ishapcha means transforming. So like, the classic example given, there's two ways to stop a thief from stealing. One is, you put him in prison. You put him in prison, he's behind bars, he can't steal. what you've really done is stopping him from acting. You're basically refraining. But you haven't transformed him. You let him out of prison, he's the same guy. Or you conquer, or in war, you conquer the enemy. Even if you control the city, it still doesn't mean you control their minds and their hearts. You may be create deterrence or threats or fear of punishment that will cause people to go cooperate. But you haven't gained their trust and you haven't gained their confidence. You can't trust them. So what's the solution? Solution is to direct and rehabilitate the thief. To train and educate people in a new way of thinking. Then you go into the department of transformation. Now, is it possible to transform without refraining? Most likely, most cases not. Think of it even a level of addiction, which, by the way, is a complete grotesque version of desire. You look at a heroin addict, a drug addict, someone who's really a junkie, who's completely dependent. You see this insane, insane need to wake up in the middle of the night for their fix. And it's hard to imagine if a person has not been there, unless if you find example yourself. But that's a grotesque, because it's not even a level of desire, it's a level of such dependence where they're like become so no longer human in a way. But it began, but if you think of it, it's a desire for that rush, for that high. They've become physically or psychologically dependent on it. So in these situations, is it possible to transform, to harness, to channel without refraining? There are perhaps some examples. But the first thing is the discipline. You need to stop the bleeding. You need to get out of the line of fire. You need the desire cannot be consuming you to the point where nothing can be done. Because if it is, then where are you going to go with it? So the bottom line is that we have to think in terms of both steps. And hopefully you can get one step to the next. But the key is to remember that even when you're doing step one, you're not stuck there. You could already be implementing step two, which is the transformation, the harnessing. But we don't want to be in denial and thinking, you know what? My desire was in the wrong place. Let me just direct it here, and that's that. Even if it may not even be doable, but even if it was doable, that's not necessarily the way to go. Refraining is necessary because you need to show that you're in control. What is the key to addiction? Is that the object, the thing that you're addicted to, is controlling you instead of you controlling it. The desire is controlling you instead of you controlling your desire. That immediately is a problem. You were created in the divine image to fulfill a mission in this world, a divine, indispensable, unique mission. How could anything in the universe take over control of your life? It goes against the entire purpose of the mission, as I said. The desires and the strengths and everything should be fulfilling the service of what your purpose and mission is. Imagine NASA sends astronauts to outer space. Or you send some people on a mission, an important mission. And they get distracted with some pleasures and desires of their own, and they forget what they were sent for. Or they get so distracted that they don't care what they were sent for. That's the equivalent, in the words of what I said before, from the duties of the heart. You can't have a love in both directions. This means that the love for the universe, the desires, preclude desiring fulfilling God's divine plan through you. But it's not the other way around. Once you know how to implement the desire of that plan, you can then channel and harness and transform the desires of the world. But you have to first get into control. Who's in control? You need to be controlling your desires, not the other way around. Now, what it means controlling, by definition, a desire is a powerful force that overwhelms us. Yeah, but you can choose where to go before it gets too late, where you're so consumed. You know, once you go deep into the water and you're submerged, obviously it's going to be very difficult to get out of there. It becomes a swamp. It becomes a quicksand, a whirlpool that draws you in. But you can determine before you get there whether you allow yourself to go there. And that's the key. So here too, as in discussing the earlier vices that we discussed, you have to know whether you're already in the throes in a place where you really feel stuck. That's one situation. Another is you're not stuck, but you know that you could get stuck and you are at the edge, or you've gotten and you're trying to be careful of not repeating past mistakes. So, with that said, let's start with the first one. If you're in a situation where you're in the throes of it, and you feel out of control, and you're listening to this, and you care to do something about it, because obviously if you're so overwhelmed and addicted and you can't do anything about it, I don't know what I'm going to say here that's going to make a difference. I don't even know if you'd be listening to this. But if you are listening to this, or you know someone that is in that situation, there you really need help. You need someone to throw you a lifeboat, a life, what was that, life, what do they call it? a rope, basically, a lifesaver. You need someone to throw you a lifesaver to simply help you out. Ein chovesh matur esatzmei. A person in fetters cannot free themselves. So you need someone to help you. If it's yourself, reach. The 12-step programs are very powerful in this regard to help you through peers and others create a creates a synergy that helps people help each other. If you know someone like that, do anything possible to help. Obviously, you can only do that much you can do. So that's clearly the first step. That's like a person who's bleeding. You got to get to the hospital. You got to get to the emergency room. If you're in a situation where you are at the edge, or you know you've slipped, or you may slip, and your desires prop up here and there, which is most of us, so you have to do things and preempt the situation, which is in two steps, as I said, the refraining part, but more importantly, the transforming part. Because if you're in a situation where you're not in the throes of it, then that alone means that you are not completely under its control and under its spell. If you're dreaming or fantasizing about something that is very desirable, so you can't just say, let me stop. That's where the harnessing and the channeling come in, which I will discuss in a few minutes, but I want to just speak about refrain. You know, someone wrote to me, many people write to me, unfortunately, this situation, porn addiction, where their family goes to sleep, or they're single, and they get to the computer, it's late at night, it's not late at night, they're bored, monotonous, and they decide, look, I got to do something. And they start wandering in the wrong places. And there's that sugar rush, the quick fix, like an addict, which you get, and sometimes it becomes something you can be consumed for with hours. You know, it's whatever it does to your brain. And you don't even feel good about it at some point. You feel like, why am I dependent on this? Now, here's a situation where you can't just say, okay, let's just shut the computer and don't do it. If you could do that, great. That's the best. You don't need my advice. Question is, what do I do to stop myself when I feel that inclination? You don't even have to, go anywhere today. So there are a few thoughts, and this comes back. I'm just using porn, which is sexuality, or not even sexuality. It's what pornography is. Is not even the true sex. I would say uplifting and transcendent element. It's the most base and degrading component, the ugly component of just coveting some, desiring something that doesn't even really mean, really have any deeper meaning to you, except if the external superficial pleasure that it creates. So in refraining, you have to see in your life what kind of self-dignity you have. One of the things that people have to realize is, I am a sacred, dignified human being. Dignity is very much connected to not doing things that are undignified. Now, is this enough? I'm not going to say it's enough, but it's something that we need to think about. So here, too, the best defense is offense. When you begin to immerse yourself in learning about your soul and about the spirituality of your life, and the more you learn about it, the more you begin to submerge in those waters, it weakens the less dignified and uglier parts of our desires and our lusts and our passions. So that's number one. Number two is recognizing also the sanctity of sexuality itself, the sanctity of desire itself. There is a sacred element to it, which we're leading up to, and recognizing that means you're abusing a power that is so necessary and so helpful in reaching great heights. By using that desire, so-called wasting it, on things that are petty and temporary and impermanent, you essentially are scrounging a tremendous resource. The resource to experience the highest states of pleasure, desire, and passion. Third, think of yourself, if you have a family, you have people that care about you. I mean, you don't want to be defiling and disgracing them, even if they're not aware of it, through your actions and behaviors. But above all, the key thing I go back to is recognizing and feeling good about yourself and what you accomplish. You'll see that especially these releases that are not healthy desires are very much connected to people not feeling good about themselves, feeling a loneliness. Now, you could say, well, sometimes it's a rush that comes from the aphrodisiac of power, of control, of excitement, and sometimes people indulge when they're in that state. That's true. That is correct. It's not always connected to a so-called melancholy state or state of loneliness. And I'm qualifying what I'm saying. However, it does associate with both that part as well. I would even argue, even if it's coming from a place where a person feels really successful, overconfident, you know, that the hormones are flowing, the stamina is there, and then they indulge in different desires, even that, if you think about it, is not coming from loneliness, correct? It's not coming from a negative, but it's still a component that is not permanent. Now, these are all thoughts just to lay the groundwork of the defanging and dissecting and so-called disarm the power of desire that leads you to the wrong places. But ultimately, the real solution is refrain as much as possible, because there's no way to begin to bring in healthy things if you're still consumed with the negative. You need to change the discipline, at least behaviorally, as much as possible. But now that leads us to the so-called the holy desire. So the same Alter Rebbe in Likutei Torah, the chapter Chukas, and this is something I've discussed, I think I gave a series of talks, maybe it was two parts, called The Anatomy of Lust and Desire. So that complements that which I'm discussing now. And there he talks about something fascinating. He cites the cryptic and mysterious red heifer mitzvah in the Torah, Zois Chukas HaTorah, which we'll be reading in Parsha Parah in the coming weeks after Purim. It's an extra reading. What is the story? How do you purify from the death, the impurity of death? So God says, take a red heifer, take its ashes and mix it with water. With water, mayim chaim, live water, water. And then sprinkle that combination on the impure, and that purifies. Now, of course, this is one of the chukim, meaning the super rational laws, and yet it's explained in Kabbalistic and Hasidic writings. And the Alter Rebbe does the job doing that by saying the following. He says that, let me straighten myself out here, that the idea of burning the cow, the red heifer represents the pleasures of this universe. A cow is a behemoth. A behemoth is symbolic of pleasure. I know I said earlier that animals don't have pleasure, but nevertheless, the animal within us is that so-called undisciplined or indulgent, I would say. An animal doesn't have extra pleasure, but an animal doesn't also have the discipline not to eat what it needs to eat. A human being can discipline themselves. So an animal represents essentially our natural and animalistic side. Doesn't necessarily mean evil, but it could also include self-indulgence and the indulgence in all pleasures. Red, the red heifer. Red, also gevura. Red is also connected to the passions. And here he does use the word fire, and fiery passions connected to this world. When you burn this, when you bring an offering and you burn the animal down to ashes, what you're doing is you're not destroying the base, the raw elements. You're destroying its extension, its fat, and its blood. Dam v'chelev. The blood is the fire, is the passion, and the chelev is the indulgence, the pleasure. Pleasure and passion. And when you burn it down to the elements, ash, so you're left with the bare original that doesn't have that inflated passion and inflated inflated, what I say, passion and fiery passion and desire and indulgence. So he said, what is the idea? That taiva, which is the word used in Tanya, the taiva satanugim, the pleasures of desires, the desire of pleasures, is something that at its core, is broken into two parts. One is its manifestation, the object of your desire, and that could be something really inappropriate or very healthy. And then there's the root of desire. The root of desire, what he calls koyach hamesava, the power to desire, is very different than the desire. Like you can have, everyone has a power of desire. A child may use that desire for playing with a game or eating a candy. An adult may do it for running after money, pursuing money or power, or for sexuality or other types of desires we may have. And another person may do it reading a book, or praying and connecting to God, or singing a beautiful song, and allowing the soul to transcend and reach great high places. They're all desires. The difference between them is, and they all come from the power of desire. The difference is the power of desire is a neutral, or he says more than neutral. It's you say dosi baharakei, it's rooted in a very sacred place. In a very powerful place. The question is channeling the desire. So this one channels it toward childish things, this one toward money or material things, and this one toward spiritual things. So it's a fascinating imagery if you think about it. Think of it like water that can feed childish things, water that can feed material things, and water that can feed spiritual. So the challenge is to eliminate and to burn down, to burn out, so to speak, the object of the desire, but not the desire itself, not the power of desire. So here we have the exact solution. The solution ultimately is to feed the desire of the soul for healthy desires. To say to someone, don't have desire, don't have passion, and just live a mediocre, non-passionate life. Firstly, for a passionate person, it's not even possible to tell them that. Even for people who are less passionate, maybe they still have the fire. Every soul has fire in it. They just maybe have never let it free, because either they grew up in a culture that beat it out of them, or their fear, or their just fear of not knowing where they're going to go with this, fear of the danger involved, etc. But every person, especially a person who is a passionate person, you can't just tell them, don't be passionate. So the answer is be passionate. Just find a different object. So find something you really enjoy, find something you're really good at, find something, and let that become the driving force of your, and channeler and harnesser of your desires. Now that is very difficult to do while you're in the throes of an unhealthy desire. That's why you need the refraining, that's why you need some type of sobriety and some type of balance, or else you're just going to get yourself into very big trouble. That's why I spoke about the different levels of where a person may be at. So the times of plenty, when things are going well, when you are able to talk about it like we're doing right now, that's when you find things to commit to with passion. You must find a passion, whether it's a passion in music or in art or in love, but it has to be channeled and directed in healthy ways. That's the key, my friends. So yes, it's a water. It's a water that feeds. It's a water that can consume and submerge and flood us in a deluge of our desires. But it's also a water that can feed and nurture and cultivate tremendous passion in the right direction. And that's our challenge. How do we channel it ultimately? How do we harness it? And the more you direct it and realize that the reason I came to this earth was not just to indulge in these short-term passions, but to be passionately connected to my purpose, then you see your talents, your skills, everything about you as being an extension of that, and that extension includes using the things you gravitate to, b'mokim shalibei chafetz, that your heart desires, using chafetz and ratzon and tainug, which are all Hebrew words, that it means to will, desire, pleasure, but and considered to be the highest levels in Kabbalah. There's an expression in the book of Sefer Yetzirah, which is the book of formation, considered one of the earliest Kabbalistic work. Ein lamayla ma'enig ve'ein lamata minega. Oinik, pleasure in Hebrew, is the same letter as reversed of nega, which is leprosy. Or nega means a disease. So it says there's nothing higher than oinik and nothing lower than nega. Which means the same letters of pleasure can go both directions. It can go towards a disease or unhealthy form of it, or it could be ein lamayla me'enig, which of course is the highest level, if you know the spheratic structure. So we have the 10 spheres, Chachma, Bina, Das, Chesed, Gvur, Tiferes, Netzach, Chod, Yesod, Malchus. Then we have Keser, the crown. And what in Keser itself? We have Arech, Ampin, Atik, Yemin, we have desire, Rotzen, and Tainug. So Tainug is considered the highest level. As a matter of fact, the whole universe, existence itself, is attributed to a desire, to a lust. The word for taiva, the same word here in chapter 1 in Tanya, in the Reb Chaim Vital Shari Kedusha, Nesava Kodesh Baruch Hu Li Yisrael Yisbaruch Dir B'Tachteinu. God lusted, God desired to have a home and a dwelling place in this lowest of worlds. The word Nesava is used. It doesn't just say Nisratz, it could have said he wants. There's the word desire is used, and that's not a mistake. That's not a oversight, as the Alter Rebbe Rabbi Shneur Zalman explains. Because if a taiva is instructing kasha, desire, you can't ask a question on a desire. You can ask a question on a person on rational behavior. Why did you do this and not that? But desire, if someone says I desire. Desire is stronger than and actually creates and is more powerful than any logic. So when you want to understand the divine, you can't use your mind. You have to go to a place. That's why we have desires that allow us to understand the divine as is before the existence of logic and rationale. So obviously, kavyachal, so to speak, we can't really apply desire and lust or pleasure to God. But when you're speaking in the language of man, in order for us to be able to relate to it, God gave us something and showed us, I too have a desire. Now, obviously, God is not bound by his desire, but nevertheless, that's his desire. That's his deepest, most expression. Which is why desire becomes the deepest, most expression by us. But it can go in two directions. You can desire things that are really inappropriate. Or you can desire what God desires. A dwelling, a home for God in this world. And that means that there's a passion. So as the Kabbalah and Hasidic masters teach us, the human personality is not created out of the blue. We were created in the divine image. Now, of course, God does not have an image, but God chose to manifest an image. And that image includes the number one and highest power of all is desire, the desire of the soul, the desire of the essence, the Sava Kodesh Baruch Hu, the essence manifesting itself in desire. So desire, if you get to the real root and anatomy of desire, is a place that is closest to the deepest, most part of our soul, which is why the things that are most desirable are really connected to the essence of who we are. Look at the power of sexuality. In my chapter in Torah Meaningful Life, it's a chapter on intimacy. I talk about this. I talk about how desire is such a fundamental principle that intimacy, which is why it's the only power to create and perpetuate our species and give birth to the great pleasure we have from our children and the continuation of generations. That pleasure did not come as an accident. The pleasure comes because it's reaching the deepest, most part of your soul, seeking its connection with the deepest, most part of the essence of God. So it's like going into the Holy of Holies. And that is ultimately the deepest pleasure of all. But it's a divine pleasure. It's not a pleasure that's here for us to indulge in. Enjoy, absolutely. In a sacred marriage, get married and enjoy pleasure as a part of a critical component in a relationship, physical relationship, intimate relationship, pleasure that comes in the rest of the relationship, as I explained there, that the intimacy is not just some secluded or compartmentalized experience. And the same thing with the other pleasures we have. As the Baal Shem Tov says, every pleasure that we have physically means that our soul really is seeking that pleasure. He even speaks about it, the attraction to a beautiful woman, or the attraction to food, or the different things we gravitate to. Says, because your soul is gravitating to the spiritual component. And that's why you need the Torah to direct you to do it in the halachic, in the right framework, not based on our indulgences, but based on what the divine purpose. But there's a purpose there. You're gravitating and drawn to it because of the divine purpose. So, obviously, great care has to be taken, as I said, to do that in the most disciplined and appropriate way. So the bottom line, my friends, is that desire is one of the most powerful forces in life. It is the essence of what the divine drives the divine as well. I said again, Kav Yochel, giving us a language so we can identify with the divine. And we bring the divine, deepest parts of the divine, the deepest, most transcendent dimensions of the cosmic, higher cosmos, into our experiences when we use our desires in that direction. Now, the more you understand that, then you say to yourself, so what am I using my desire for? Where is it being released? Where is it being expressed? Where am I channeling it? So it's rooted, so it's all grows from water, and that's why everything in existence begins, but it can go in places, like this is what in the end of chapter 1 in Tanya, and the Rav Chaim V'Tal talking about the Midas Rois, the negative part of desire, where desire becomes the antithesis, the alter ego, complete consuming you and destroying your life, which is what it has that power to do, like water that floods and submerges us. So our mission is to understand what desire is, channel it, and realize the great benefits that it can bring to your life. So I hope I covered this in a way that it does justice to this topic. Next week we're going to talk about derivatives from that, called coveting others, what others have, other people's possessions, other people's family, wife, and also the next week will be envy and jealousy. So this has been Simon Jacobson speaking to you from the Holy Land, the Promised Land, which Moses desired to enter, not, as the Talmud says, not for its fruits, but for be able to perform the mitzvahs that we can only perform in this Promised Land. And I'm sitting, and I wish you were able to see, when you see, if you look at, we're going to try to connect it to the video that I made earlier, where you could see the water and the background, and I bid you all a very pleasurable and enjoyable week. It's the month of Adar Simcha, which is a type of cousin to pleasure, and a very desire, a passionate week directed towards healthy passions. So on a practical note, we begin step by step. Here's a practical suggestion. Tomorrow morning, or tonight, but each day, we're always going to do things that give us some pleasure. It may be a coffee break, it may be a conversation with someone, it may be things that are inappropriate or even illicit, maybe things that are very beautiful. Focus on it. Maybe create a journal. Write down, what are the pleasures and desires I indulged in today? And see, firstly, the ones that you really are almost embarrassed and don't even want to write, the ones that are more neutral, and the ones that you can really say, I'm proud of this type of desire. And then look at them and see, what can I do in each of these three columns? The inappropriate, the neutral, and the ones that are very positive. What can I do with the positive? How can I even expand that? You know, maybe sending a beautiful email to people and getting the pleasure of just helping someone. And the neutral, how could I direct that toward a positive thing? The neutral can be, you know, just socializing without anything positive going on online, or meeting somebody in a social setting, or in whatever setting of business and so on, channeling it to something that's pleasurable toward the pleasure that God has, which is somewhat taking your corner of the world and making it a divine home. And as far as the listen and appropriate, I mean, of course, my first suggestion is try to stop and refrain and just control. But if it's still part of your life, at least begin by thinking, what can I do that will somewhat weaken? What can I do to harness? What can I do to take that desire and direct it to something positive? Even the beginning of awareness of the problem, and if you're able to acknowledge it, is a great way to go. Because these first steps of awareness, yediyah samacha, knowing the problem is half its cure, is the key to solving things. These are practical suggestions you can implement. Think of hobbies, skills, talents, other great things that you are able to do. Why are you not doing it? Maybe it's something that you're frustrated. Now is the time to introduce those new, passionate things in your life. This has been Simon Jacobson. Until next Wednesday, 8:15, 8:30, we will continue with part 4. Please send us your questions, your comments. Subscribe to our MeaningfulLife.com weekly newsletter roundup. And all the other great things that we're doing recently, we launched this soul workout. And God bless you all. And until next week, everyone be well.